Accession number 9146, rule number 9.
Brigadier Wedderburn Maxwell, tape 9. Did you ever get to Paris on leave?
Every time I changed my unit, I put in for leave to go to Paris. And they never thought to ask me if I'd already had a Paris leave. And so that was that. And Paris was absolutely marvellous in springtime. We stayed at the Edouard set and did ourselves proud. Me and another Palmer, who was another great friend of mine, we went there and we misbehaved as one would expect. And that's the first time. Then a month or two later, I got another, when I moved to another battery, I think on promotion this time, I put in for leave again and got it. And Roland and Herbert Palmer and I went off again. And then when we came back, we'd gone down to the Aisne. And I'd met Daisy Broderick and her mother, and they, by this time, had gone to Paris. And so, I think they were in Paris. But our little girlfriend of the first two visits, she... I said, now this time, je suis vive en camarade seulement. And parce que je suis fiancé, ou presque fiancé. And this little sweetie, she was a most attractive little monkey. And she took it all in very good part, and we just took her around Paris in cars and gave her wonderful food and gave her white fox fur, which she always wanted all her life. And that was that. That was my three efforts at Paris. Except the last time I was there, suddenly, Paris was being shelled from a very great distance. They had a gun, a very, very long-range gun, firing from the forest where they signed the peace treaty. What was it? It wasn't Dieppe, was it? Forêt de Compiègne. And this gun had a tremendous range on it. It was a pure for moral effect, but it was dropping these shells in Paris. And every quarter of an hour people did that and got undercover somewhere, or went into a shop or into a cellar, and then there would be a boom, and then you'd hear a whistle through the air, and then this shell would arrive, and then you were all right for another 15 minutes. And the little cocher drove past with his horse cab, and covered with dust, his snow white, him and his horse and his cab, he'd been almost in the middle of one of these shell bursts, perfectly intact.
Where would you have been when the great Allied offensive?
I was in bed in Paris, Toussaint, and the waiter brought up the Paris edition of the Daily Mail and my fried Dover sole. That's the way I lived, like a fighting cock. I had £250 in the bank, and I said, I'm not going to get killed with that in the bank, and decided that's why I went to Paris, and I spent about £100 a time, which was a lot of money in those days. And what happened next?
When you returned to the front.
Then I went back. I found my battery on the top of Vimy Ridge, which the Canadians had captured the year before, with a wonderful outlook right across the Loups Plain towards Douai and various other mining French towns. And there we had this, as I say, this wonderful view, and we lived in great comfort. And then, when you asked about the Black Day of the War for Ludendorff, wasn't it? In bed, when the waiter brought me my breakfast and everything, he handed me the Daily Mail, and this, here it's announced, a huge assault by the British forces, and so many guns captured, so many infantry captured, and so many miles of ground captured. And this was the beginning. And Haig did a magnificent end of the war. He's always blamed for Passchendaele, but I don't know there was any alternative but Passchendaele, even now. That we had to stay in the war, and the only way we could do it was by attacking. But here we had the Germans in full flight, and army after army was moved forward on a 10-20 mile front right through till I got back and found them as far as a place called Saint-Amand, just short of Mons, and moving forward the following day, the men, knowing peace was practically there, threw their tin hats away and really went easy, quite against my orders, I think. And my colonel, who was one of the great men of my life, Douglas Foreman, he saw this. He said, "Oh, what's happening here? Is your disgrace to let your battalion's discipline go? I put Mitchell Moore in command, and you can get back out of it." And I was really ticked off and deserved it. But we finished up just north of Mons village itself on the main road, and as the clock struck 11, I said one round gunfire, and every gun went off. Finished.
That was the end.
Yeah.
And how did that come? How did you feel when you heard about the armistice?
Funny this. I talked about this to Oliver Chandos, because he was brigade major for the Guards Brigade at the time. And that night, when the news came through, ceasefire, as I say, at 11 o'clock, and I let off my guns for the last time. And then came through the message to the terms of the armistice. They were absolutely shattering. Kind of 10,000 traction engines, 50,000 lorries, God knows how many, all the guns, this, that, and other. The Germans are absolutely stripped of everything. Straight away like that. It was a wonderful thing, but it was a most exciting thing to read about. And then the day wore on, and the evening came, and I was a temporary major, and my captain and two subalterns, we went to bed stone cold sober and depressed. The most extraordinary feeling. The one thing in life that mattered is finished. And Oliver told me he had the same sort of feeling with the Guards Brigade, and the thing that helped them to keep order, maintain their full, wonderful discipline, was the long march, slogging it, from the end of the war to the Cologne.
Did you have any problems with discipline?
Yes. After that, after the war was over, I was still commanding this battalion, having a very good time shooting with my shooting partridges and so on. And then they proceeded to break up the division. They had to demobilize the men as quick as they could, and that was a big job. And when they came to the officers, I was the only regular there. I was posted up to command a battery in the Rhine Army, which was holding a bridgehead over the Rhine in case the Germans didn't sign the peace. And the peace terms were being debated in Paris almost immediately after the armistice. Anne's father was the governor of the Bank of England at the time, and so he was a very important man running the financial side of the first peace treaty in Versailles. And Anne was out there as a little 16-year. Anyhow, I went up. I was ordered to go to a corps headquarters and report. I went and reported to General Kirby, and he said, "Glad to see you. You're going to go to the Southern Division. You'll find things have got a bit slack there, but you're a regular soldier and you know how to deal with it." And I thanked him and went off, wondering what he meant. And I got to the division, and the general there welcomed me and said, "You find things aren't quite ordinary now, you know, things have got a bit slack and discipline's not, but you've got to look after it." And so I wondered what the hell I was going to find waiting for me to command. And I went up to command, and I found four of the most depressed-looking officers I'd ever seen, sitting around having a drink in the mess. Nobody saluted me when I came in. The men paid no attention. They were all, some of them had officers' hats on, some of them, they were HAC, the Honourable Artillery Company. And I was amazed at this, and I kept my mouth shut for the first day, and I went down and saw everything. The men's hair wanted cutting, the horses weren't even being groomed. You did this to a horse, and You got a handful of hair, just fell out. So at the end of the day, I said I'd been warned that things weren't good, and this is what is going to happen from now onwards. We're going to have peacetime surgery, we're going to have stables in the early morning, we're going to have stables at night, in a minute the horse is going to be groomed twice a day, you're going to exercise, and you're going to work. And the sergeant major said, can I speak, sir? I had the sergeant major, six sergeants and the quartermaster sergeant, and the officers, in a little office like this room. I said, this is what's going to happen. Of course, the sergeant major said, before you say anything more, sir, may I tell you that the numbers one, that's the sergeants, the number one in the gun detachment, the numbers one, and I have pledged the men, we will resist any attempt of the officers to increase their work. And I swallowed very quickly, and I said, tomorrow morning, to the captain, tomorrow morning I want the whole battery on parade at 9 o'clock. When I say the whole battery, I mean including officers, servants, cooks, sentries, line orderly with the horses, every man in the battery. And that I went to bed and thought it all over. And next morning I got up, I went down to my office, and at 9 o'clock the captain came and reported all prone and correct. And there was a whole battery and one great long line on the parade ground. And so I said to the captain, number them. And they numbered 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, all the way down the line. And I said, so 10 or 18, whatever it was, men short. He said, oh yes, sir, they're the officer servants and the cooks. You had my orders last night. Let me know in the office when all the men in the battery are on parade. And I went off to my office and sat very shortly. Captain came back and said, everybody, battery present, and all ranks on parade, sir. So then I started on them. And I said that I'd been warned that the discipline got bad. I said, this is quite shocking what I've found. You're going to work, you're still soldiers, and there's no peace. You will, in future, if you want to wear officers' equipment, like brown boots, funny hats, and so on, you've got to earn them by getting your commissions. And so on, and I said, I've never seen horses looking like this lot did. You're going to groom them until we get their coats right. And I understand, have a complaint at not being demobilized. You've been out here since 1916. I've just left a battery that came out in 1914, and if I had any say in it, I wouldn't let a man go. I was very angry. I wouldn't let a man go till every man I'd just left back who came out in 1914 had been released. And finally, then the quartermaster sergeant stepped forward from the ranks and saluted. I said, what is it, quartermaster? QMS. He said, well, sir, I think that the men will resent the way you talked about them not coming out in 1917. I said, look here, there are no such things as collective complaints. You complain for yourself if you like, but you don't complain for all these men. It's forbidden in the army, collective complaints. And fall in, Sergeant Quartermaster fell in. And then I finish up by saying, I understand there's some idea that you're going to not going to do your work or obey orders in this battery. And all I can say is this, that this is a sheer mutiny, and I've only been here for 24 hours. So I won't get into trouble, but by God you will, and I'll see you do. But I said, just don't believe it. I don't believe you, you're the elite. And that was that.
And did they rally to that?
I had the battery dismissed. I started a sport at once, jumping the horses. I got it down so I could stick my sword in the ground and jump it. Men holding a rope at each end and the horse jumping in between. Football, boxing, all the sport, and I'd got with me, I brought up a little thoroughbred horse. It really was a thoroughbred horse, a very, very good horse indeed, which Mickey O'Sullivan had got for me from the ranks. He found it. And this is a little horse I called Eau de Cologne. And I entered him at a big race meeting in Cologne, run by the veterinary officers, all the vets, of course, they always were wrapped up in their horses. And the vets thought they'd really got some money on the big race, the St. Leger, whatever they call it, St. Leger Handicap. And as I rode down to the start on my little Eau de Cologne, one of the vets looked at me like that. He said, "What's that you've got hold of there?" "That was a horse I've had." He said, "Where did you get him?" And he was an Irishman. And I said, "It's my horse, that's all that matters." And he absolutely romped home in this race. I mean, I was such an amateur, I won by about literally 30 or 40 lengths. It was quite fantastic. And then the horse wasn't fully extended. He was a really good thoroughbred horse. And he won this cup. And I took it around the barrack room. I got the cup next door. I took the cup around the barrack room, followed by a cask of beer, and every man had it.
So it would seem you ended up having mutual respect, I would think.
Very much so. Before this, the men were already in my pocket before I told them the horse was going to win. And they were already right in my pocket, 8-1. But after that, or about that time, there was a very big competition throughout the division for sport, games, and parade. And the HAC swept the board. Well, that was practically the end of it all for me. I was very proud of them, and they were a magnificent lot of men. I said, "You're the elite of the Royal Artillery, and you contemplate a mutiny. You can't do it. You're not mad. But if you do as I say, I've been here 24 hours and nobody can blame me."
Do you think that was a unique case, or do you think that happened quite a lot?
Well, in my case, the whole story, I should think probably was more or less unique. I don't know, because I never heard of it. But what I did hear of was a general of the neighbouring division, the artillery general, when he heard the men were restive, he cut out all parades and let the men just do nothing. Gave orders and paraded, all parades and all training has got to cease from now onwards. And I call that quite disgraceful. It's in the end of my little book, but this is the end as far as I was concerned. I still had another week or two before I left there. The Germans were refusing to sign the peace treaty. They were still on, there was no fighting, the armistice was in existence, but all the way along the River Rhine, as you look at the map, is this the Rhine running up now? There's a bulge there of Belgian troops, there's a big bulge of the British troops from Cologne, there was a big one of the American troops down at Mainz, and the French further south. All these bridgeheads over the river, really, if the Germans did refuse, to go straight in and seize the Rhine, and seize the Ruhr. Well, when the Germans looked like refusing to sign, we were moved up from our position. I was just stationed just beyond Cologne, a place called Berg-Gladbach, and I was moved up with my HAC to just below a place called Remscheid, near Solingen, the great steelworks. And the river was kind of a dark blue, funny-looking water pouring down past us. And before we left my camp down at Berg-Gladbach to go up there, I appointed two of my young officers to see the place were left spotlessly clean, go through everything. And with that I went up. And then the young officers came up and reported. And then the colonel sent for me. He said, "I've had a complaint from the people who've taken over your billets. They say you've left them in a disgusting state. And you'll be removed. And Major Terry will take over command of this battery." Well, it was a bit of a smack in the eye. Major Terry was an ex-quartermaster sergeant of the HAC, and it was the old boy net of the HAC people getting him appointed to command the HAC battery and getting me out of it. I was very sore, and it very hurt, because I'd stopped the mutiny and won the divisional championship. And I couldn't ask much more of a boy of 25. It was my birthday when this happened, my 25th birthday. And that was the end of that war, as far as I was concerned. Well, I did. But that's another story that comes into average for his rank. I didn't want to go. I was told by a lot of my friends who read my little book, Young Contemptible, that I must tell them what happened to the Young Contemptible, which is me, and the reasons in there. You read the reason for it, the German reason, Young Contemptible. Right. They said, you must tell us what happened to him. And so in the end, I decided I would. And I wrote a book of Between the Wars, which started me getting married, and then took us through our early married life, and India, and all sorts of things, right up till the Second War came along. That booklet I called Young Contemptible. The old Contemptibles were the original British Expeditionary Force. And it was a magnificent army. It was an entirely volunteer army, and long-service professional soldiers. And what there was, it was absolutely wonderful. The Kaiser ran it down to the extent of trying to pour scorn on us as a contemptibly little army. And anybody who says who quotes him saying that a contemptible little army is wrong. It was contemptibly small. And that was why it was called, we reposted at once by calling ourselves the Old Contemptibles.
And you called your book The Young Contemptible?
Yes. Being me, because I am an Old Contemptible, you see.
Legitimately so.
It was people who were in France in the First War between the 2nd of August 1914 and the 14th, I think it was, or the 22nd of November. I didn't see any fighting during that early bit, but they had to draw a line somewhere, and we are, well, there are very few of us left now, as you can imagine.
Well, thank you very much indeed for telling us your war experiences. I really feel we'll have to come again and hear what happened in World War II one day. But I wonder if you would bear with me a little longer. There are one or two more questions I'd like to ask you. If I could ask you about the relationship between the artillery and the signals people, were these relationships always good? Did you find you cooperated very well together?
Yes, I never. Of course, one was with the regular division, and one was perforce helping, cooperating with everybody. And the signals did the telephonic communication between the top, the head office, the general, the divisional commander, down to brigades, I think, and from brigades onwards, and from OPs to batteries, in my case, we did our own. We very early on ran out of the telephone wires, and they issued us rather cleverly with a very, very fine wire and sort of an enamel or paint, almost a paint covering to it, insulation, so that it didn't short on the ground. And it was much, much easier to turned it out. It was turned out in enormous quantities, and you just ran these wires out as you went along.
Did you ever find it was the case that sometimes you might have a signalling group attached to artillery that might make your position more vulnerable, in as much that the Germans might spot what they were doing? They might be highly visible.
No, because by then, when you were in that sort of contact with the enemy, on the whole, you weren't visible. I mean, you put your lines out at night, for instance. You did an awful lot of everything at night. One thing About the night work, I'd like to bring in, I don't know if I can bring it in here, but that first winter, the awful conditions of life altogether. We artillery, the drivers, lived behind, away from the guns with the horse lines, say 2 miles back. But to help the infantry, every night we sent up a third of our men to help the infantry dig their trenches, carry up their wire, carry up their stores, and help the infantry. So that in our case, the men got very, very tired. Tonight they would be on sentry duty around the horses, seeing they didn't get into trouble and difficulties on. Tomorrow night they'd be helping the infantry, and the third night they'd have in bed if they were lucky. And that went on all that winter. So it was a very good example of how very intimately the gunners and the infantry worked and fought.
Yes, that was my next question, really. I was going to ask you more explicitly about the relationship between the artillery and the infantry. How did you look at the their position compared with your own? Did you think they had a more vulnerable, more dangerous position?
Oh, so much so.
You hear the PBI.
They were called the PBI, the poor bloody infantry. And we pitied them and we admired them and we did all we could. All we could the whole time. Sometimes it worked and sometimes it didn't.